In this episode, we're talking with Jared McCabe from Wakeland Property Advisory in Melbourne, and we're going to discover what's happening in the Melbourne property market. Why are property values not rising there like they are in many other cities? And have all of those lockdowns had a material impact on the Melbourne property market? Meanwhile, rents have been steadily rising. Is this having a knock-on effect in the apartment market?
Welcome to The Elephant in the Room. This is the podcast where we love to talk about the big things in property that never usually get talked about. I'm Veronica Morgan, real estate agent, buyer's agent and buyer's agent mentor, co-host of Foxtel's Location, Location, Location Australia, author of Auction Ready and co-host of Your First Home Buyer Guide.
And I'm Chris Bates, mortgage broker, recently ranked number 5 in Australia out of over 18,000 brokers in the annual MPA Top 100 Mortgage Broker Award. Before we get started, I need to let you know that nothing we say here can be taken as personal advice. We always recommend you engage the services of an appropriate and experienced professional.
Our guest today is Jared McCabe, buyer's agent and director of Wakeland's Property Advisory. It's been a while since we've caught up with you, Jared, and we're very well overdue for a chat. And so welcome back.
Thanks for having me. It's good to talk to you both.
Jared, thanks so much for coming back. It has been a while. And Veronica and I were talking about, I think Melbourne's getting a bit of a bad run in the property news media, I guess, right? I think it's only got up about 15-20% since COVID, right? And a lot of other places have got up 50-60%. And, you know, it's kind of the poor cousin, I guess, the underperformer. But I don't know whether the fundamentals are really going to show that longer term. So what's actually happening on the ground? Because, you know, I actually see a cyclical argument to get into Melbourne. But what are you seeing?
Well, I would agree with that. I mean, I can't disagree with a lot of what you've said in terms of the performance and how things have been tracking since the start of COVID till now. I mean, we had some reasonable growth through the back end of 2020 and into 2021. But then with the multiple lockdowns we had then, it sort of interrupted things where a lot of other cities didn't have that. But we haven't really recovered post-COVID either, like some of the others have continued to build. And I do think a lot of that is to do with the hangover from COVID. I think there's still a lot of, and it's not just property related, but it flows onto it. There's constant talk in the media about the debt that the government's now in as well, which flows onto confidence and that sort of thing as well. And obviously they're trying to recover a lot of that debt, and some of that is flowing through in property taxes. So there's a lot of that that's coming into play, which is impacting the market.
So according to CoreLogic, right, Melbourne's the only capital city to record a negative quarterly movement. That's for the beginning of this year, with prices down 0.2%. And over the past 12 months, the dwelling values have grown 3.2%, whereas Sydney rose 9.6%. So that's bang on 3 times the amount. And Brisbane, Adelaide and Perth were all in the double digits. So, of course, you know, you look to that and we have spoken about some of those taxation changes, and particularly in regards to the investor climate, if you like, in Melbourne. But talking to other buyer's agents, it's still not easy to buy a good property. And so, as per usual, I guess when things tighten up, stock levels tighten up. Yep. So there's less property on the market, even though you've had investors selling out and all the rest of it. I mean, All these things can be true at the same time, right? It makes it complicated, doesn't it? It's not like it suddenly prices don't rise and so therefore it's a buyer's market. It doesn't actually work that way, does it?
No, it doesn't matter whether it's Melbourne or where it is. That's always the case. Buyers constantly talk about wanting to be able to purchase when the market's low. But the negative to that is, well, no vendor chooses to sell when the market's low. So the choice and the quality of stock is never going to be as good in that space when that happens. And I mean, the other thing that is happening a lot at the moment, not a lot, but there's quite a bit of investors that perhaps, and we'll go through this, I guess, as to why they're selling, but there are a number of them selling. And a lot of those that are choosing to are probably choosing to sell secondary stock that hasn't performed as well. And therefore they're putting that onto the market. And therefore that's not selling as well either. So it becomes a vicious circle.
Yeah, Jared, I mean, I'd love to because it's not all parts of Melbourne have, say, underperformed, right? Like, it's, you know, with COVID, it changed Melbourne as a city, not just because of the lockdowns, but, you know, there were changes with work from home and remote work. And, you know, that allowed people to maybe move a little bit further away from the city than they really hugged the capital city or come to Melbourne CBD before, because it was a nightmare getting around and driving. You know, all the roads were clogged up. So has that sort of shifted out a little bit? You know, like instead of Brunswick, it was Coburg and Preston, and then, or maybe it was you know, maybe they're up in the, you know, eastern suburbs and Eltham, suburbs that traditionally underperformed, have sort of really caught up, and have the buyers actually now started going back towards the city with return to work, or what's happening?
Yeah, they have, but even, I mean, interestingly enough, we found more so this year that wasn't so much the case through the spring last year, but even some of the single fronted cottages and terraces in the inner city suburbs have not had the depth of interest this year that perhaps you would traditionally expect them to. Even in a flatter market, you'll quite often find that there'll be at least two or three property on the good quality ones. There'll be two or three people that'll still bid on it. And that may not mean that it'll fly at an auction, but it'll still have competition. It'll get to the reserve and it'll transact. Whereas even some of the better quality ones have found that there's been passings or the need to sell prior to auction this year. So there's not the same depth. And I was saying to Veronica earlier, it's quite inconsistent. It's not a case of it's this sector of the market that's doing well and this sector that's not. There's some areas that are really you would expect to be doing quite well because they do have levels of multifaceted demand and they're not relying on one buyer profile. But even there, there's still not necessarily the competition that's driving things forward.
And what do you reckon about this sort of rental crisis down there? Because Melbourne's typically had a lot lower yields, a lot of choice for a renter, right? Like, yeah, you could rent an apartment, but you could also rent houses, right? There's a lot of investor houses down there. How have you noticed that shift with investors selling, you know, rents going up?
Yeah.
You know, is that affecting the market or is it still a bit like, you know, there's still a lot of choice out there and the rental crisis isn't as bad?
No, the rental crisis is quite bad. I mean, there's a lot. I think the vacancy rate is certainly well below 1% at the moment. So it's quite tight and it's across the board. There's a lot of, I know of a story last year of a very basic two-bedroom apartment out in Footscray, older style block, poor positioning the block, not a well-maintained block, on a main road, and there was, and it wasn't a cheap rent, but there was 20 or so people lined up out the front ready to apply to lease that property. So, and that's not a one-off. It's happening time and time again. So we've gone from, say, 18 months, 2 years ago to where if your property wasn't well-maintained and in reasonable condition, then tenants would just move on to the next one to, you don't need to do anything at the moment, and which is sort of flying in the face of the rental changes that came in at the start of 2021, where there was this expectation that you needed to improve standards, which I think was a good thing to do. But it's really changed dramatically in the last 18 months, and most properties, unless you're very, very unrealistic with your expectations of what it should rent for, are renting very quickly.
Is that encouraging a lot of renters to then try to enter as first home buyers, et cetera? Do you think that rental crisis is, you know, when you've got choices to rent, there's no pressure to buy, like then you just sort of sit on the sidelines. It's not growing Melbourne, right?
But yeah.
Do you think they go, actually, my rent's going up, the Melbourne market isn't moving, he's noticing there's a lot more competition from, say, first home buyers who want to get out of rent?
Starting to, but first home buyers, as you'll both know, are notoriously sensitive to interest rates as well. So with the rises that we've had in that space, it's made it quite difficult there. I've had a few clients that have gone from and young first home buyers who've been considering buying their first home, but have decided to buy their first investment property and stay with their parents just because they can get a slightly higher loan, get a slightly better property, generate the income that's guaranteed pretty much at the moment from a rental and go down that path.
It's interesting you say that. I mean, obviously, the other podcast I do is Your First Home Buyer Guide, and we've got a course for first home buyers. And some of our students, but one recently bought in Ballarat, so Melbourne-based, decided to buy in Ballarat. They're in healthcare, so they can easily find jobs there. And we were sort of talking about why they chose to do that rather than go the outskirts of Melbourne. And they're basically saying, well, when you look around, to go to Geelong, for example, or to Ballarat, the public transport, if you are going to commute to Melbourne, is actually better than it is from new subdivisions on the edge of Melbourne's outskirts. So that's a different, I mean, if you look in Sydney, for example, you know, the options, you go to Newcastle or Wollongong, it's a fair trip on the train to get into Sydney if you decide you want to commute. But, you know, and our urban sprawl is constrained by mountains and water. Melbourne doesn't have that. I mean, you're going to end up in Adelaide soon, aren't you?
Well, that's part of the reason that the supply is constantly on the increase and there's not the same pressure, I guess, compared to some of the other cities, because there is that sprawl in Melbourne and there's so much farmland available to be able to continue to develop. I mean, Ballarat's a really good example. I mean, the regional cities around Melbourne, though, are relatively close. I mean, Bendigo is probably the furthest away, and it's literally inside 2 hours. But Geelong and Ballarat are both very close, and the train linkages there are really good, and so are the road linkages. So, and the benefits of, say, and I can speak to Ballarat. I went to boarding school there and worked there for 5 years before moving to Melbourne. And it's it's got a lot of lifestyle attributes. It's got some really nice real estate there. The weather's not great, but they've got the lake in the middle of town. There's a lot of really good quality period homes. There's some good estates that are being developed on the outskirts of town as well. So there's really good options there. And post-COVID, when there was a real increase in property demand and values there, there's probably some good value to be had there at the moment because it hasn't. It's probably come back a little bit, like a lot of the regional areas around Melbourne have.
Jared, I'm going to be in Melbourne in a couple of weeks and a day in the city of a bunch of meetings. And I'm just curious because, you know, when you're on the street, it is a Monday, so, you know, every day is different in the city, right? Like, at the it used to always be the same. You know, the coffee shops are always the same, busy every day. But, like, is the mojo back? Like, are people or are some people like, oh, you know, I don't want to go into the city? Like, are people really wanting to return to work down there? Because Melbourne's always about the city life, right? The cafes, the restaurants, the laneways.
Yep.
You know, you went to work, you went out after work, you know, that sort of life. Or is that still like lagging a bit?
And it's lagging, Chris, and it's still not, certainly not what it was. It's gradually coming. My brother-in-law's got a couple of physio practices in the city, and so he keeps me up to date with what's going on. And yeah, it's not the same as what it was. And then you look at some of the well-known restaurants. I mean, Ginger Boy's a very well-known restaurant in Melbourne, which has just shut its doors after 18 years. And that's because they just can't. So it's still not back to what it was, that's for sure.
And I guess is that playing into like buyers' minds and saying, well, I'm willing to go a little bit further to get more for my money? And, you know, they're not feeling that pressure to sort of try to stay close to the city. Like, are your home buyers thinking like that, or are they still?
No, the home buyers seem to feel to be back. They seem to the feel is that they're back to more what they were. It does feel as though that the draw to the city, not so much the CBD itself, but the lifestyle that the inner city suburbs offer around Melbourne. So your Richmond's, Fitzroy, South Yarra, that sort of an area, people still want to be there, and they're really doing quite well in the over the weekends in terms of activity and hubs and things. And obviously with the football, the arts precincts and things back in full swing, that's all doing quite well. It's more the CBD itself.
Yeah.
During the Monday to Friday 9 to 5 sort of hours, where it's just not quite back to what it was.
Now, one of the things about Melbourne that I always found was quite remarkable, and that, you know, particularly it was like the first apartment boom, really. You know, what, Melbourne, then Brisbane, then Sydney, and over the boom that we had, sort of 2012, 2017, you know, Melbourne apartment prices were woeful compared to house prices. And obviously, you look at an aggregate market with all the different types of stock you've got in there, but it was obviously dragged down a lot by, you know, the Docklands and the South, you know,
South Bank.
Thank you. South Bank, I was going to say Southport. What's happening in that space now? Are those apartments, particularly with the pressure or the vacancy rates? I mean, I think also Melbourne had something like the highest increase in yields, which of course... CoreLogic was saying, but of course that's tempered by the fact that prices haven't risen as much. Yeah. That's going to obviously have a positive impact on yields. But, you know, you've had rental increases, because I remember when a lot of those properties were even struggling to rent. So you couldn't rent them, you couldn't sell them. And now you've got this massive pressure in terms of rentals and demand there. Is that having any impact on the values of those properties? Is it changing the feel in those areas even?
Not particularly on values for that type of property. There's still not a huge amount of demand for them, because the most buyers still don't want to enter into that market. There's an understanding that it's probably not where you want to be from an investment perspective. And from a lifestyle point of view, a lot of the buyers that are getting into the market don't want to be in those high rises. They'd probably prefer to be in the inner suburban type locations as opposed to being in those high rise developments. So, there has been a lot trying to be sold, although now that they can get a reasonable rental return on them, some are prepared to do that. But a lot of them also now moving to the land tax bracket that's now applicable, where it perhaps wasn't previously, because that's been introduced at the start of this year as well. So that's brought them to the fore in terms of perhaps I wasn't having to pay land tax because the my land value is sub 300,000. Well, now if it's over 50, it's applicable.
Oh my God, I hadn't thought of that.
It's such a big change, that land tax, right? Can you just sort of, you know, tell our listeners a little bit about that in particular, but also how's that changed behavior, right? How is that? Because that's the issue, right? You change legislation, you change the incentive, you change behavior. And, you know, are you seeing people not buying investment properties looking to upgrade their home? You know, they're looking to sell their investment properties just because they hate paying tax. Like, they don't care. You know, there's changes people's behavior, right?
It does, yeah. And there's been a lot of people that have reconsidered their position based off. And I don't think it's just that. It's death by a thousand cuts for a lot of investors down here. It's not just the land tax has probably tipped it over the edge in the last 6 to 12 months when that was, well, it was introduced at the start of this year, but when it was started to be spoken about and when it was going to be introduced. But you factor that into then as well, the interest rate rises and obviously everyone's copped, but then also the changes to the Residential Tenancies Act that came in 2021. And so it's just bit by bit. And all of a sudden, they just feel, a lot of investors just feel, this is just too hard. I'm expanding too much. For some people, I've had a number of clients that the companies bought properties for 20, 25 years ago. They've served their purpose. They've done what they needed to. They would probably have kept them for another 5 years or so if they could, but it's just gotten to the point where it's just, no, we just don't want the hassle anymore.
Yeah.
And so we'll move on from it. And so, Chris, your question around are people considering, they absolutely are considering upgrading their homes, and whether that's upgrading by doing renovation works or just upgrading by selling and buying up. It's probably more the latter, because that's another thing that's leveraged on top is the cost of work and having to deal with trades. Mm. There's not a really strong appetite to do that either. So there's been a stronger market in that renovated property, and so people are considering doing that a lot more as well. So that comes into play too.
Yeah, so you've got a house with $2 million, you're thinking, oh, maybe I'll buy another little terrace in Northcote or, you know, Brunswick for $1-1.5 million or something, instead of doing that and paying land tax and, you know, be anti-investor, I'll just upgrade my home to $3 million. Like, that's because I don't pay land tax and it goes to me tax-free. And I've got heaps of equity anyway, hence why I was thinking about buying an investment property. That seems like a better bet.
If I'm in a good blue chip location where I'm going to get good capital growth out of the family home as well, then when I get to the point down the track when my home is worth $5 million and I only need a $2.5, $3 million home, well, I've got the equity there and I can downsize and still be in a good position. So that's definitely playing into people's minds.
Are you finding, though, that it's a tack on how, I mean, I know the land tax at $50,000, it's still, you know, the amount of land tax you'd pay on an apartment's still quite small, right? You know, unless you're on a really small block of units or something. But are you still seeing this as an attack on investors who have got houses? And, you know, do you really see that if that stays like that, you know, ongoing, that it's going to be even harder and harder to rent a house? Or do you think there's just a lot of investors who own houses down there and there's still just going to be, you know, a significant amount of house rentals available?
There are still a lot, but I mean, it just seems to be mixed messages is what a lot of investors are feeling, is that they're, in one hand, you're telling us that there's not the rental market's too tight, there's not enough property available, and how are we going to fix that? But in the other hand, you're increasing taxes and disincentivizing investors and landlords to want to be in that marketplace anymore. So it just feels like there's not a consistent message and not a consistent want from the powers that be.
There's not consistent arguments about that even. I mean, you know, like the idea that for every landlord that sells is a celebration in some quarters because they think that a homeowner is going to buy that property. Mm. And yes, maybe the homeowner does buy that property, but it doesn't always free up a rental for somebody else, you know. And
if you're coming out of a communal living situation, the other two people that you live with are still going to be there.
Well, you're moving out of home, you know, you've been moved home to save up to buy. I mean, and this is the sort of the arguments missed quite a lot, unfortunately. But there's, you know, as we all know, there's a lot of sympathy for property investors in this country. I watched Q&A. We've got Dr. Cameron Murray coming back on the podcast. He's going to talk about his book, The Great Housing Hijack, in May sometime. And I was watching Q&A the other night on the ABC, and there was all these politicians and there was him, and there was also somebody from I think it was an Aboriginal family. I'm not exactly sure what association that she was representing, but, you know, all these questions were directed at the pollies and all the same answers kept coming out. And
yeah.
I watched his face and I was like, how is he coping with sitting there listening to all this drivel from people who really don't know what they're talking about? But there was one investor that asked this question. It was like, you know, why is everyone to have a go at us? It was quite phenomenal, and there was so little sympathy there. You know, and a lot of rhetoric from the pollies, but not a lot of sympathy. And it was just, you know, really interesting that you can hold this argument that, you know, it's really bad for renters out there, rents are rising and all the rest of it, but we're not going to look after landlords.
No one brought that up 3 years ago when it was the landlords that were subsidising the rent reductions.
Exactly.
I mentioned that.
Exactly. And in fact, I'm working on a presentation on ethics in real estate at the moment. And I was looking at the report, the ethics report, I think it's called, from the Governance Association of Australia, I should check my sources. But anyway, it was really interesting because the perception of real estate agents last year as being ethical, bottom of the list for all the occupations. And it noted that effectively the fickleness or the hypocrisy, because only a few years earlier, our perception of it being ethical was risen substantially because property managers were the custodians of helping people. You know, it goes the other way, and it's like we just, you know, it's like it's easily forgotten. So it's quite fascinating how that changes on a dime, and it's all self-interest, let's face it.
Yeah. Jared, Melbourne, I'm going to go buy an investment down there or buy a home or move to Melbourne. What's the long-term pitch? Like why is it still on the cards? It's going to be one of our best performers, and why is it, you know, still got all the right fundamentals?
You mentioned before, Chris, that cyclical nature, and I think that's going to be a big part in it. I don't think Melbourne's going to get held down for that low. I think it's been down, even the housing sector during COVID, relatively speaking, to other areas. I think it's it hasn't performed as well as it should and could. And so I think there's a lot of scope. I'm not saying that that's going to change in the next 6 to 12 months, but I think once the market does shift, it'll start to really pull back. I mean, one of Richard Wakeland's favourite sayings, and he's been obviously doing this for a hell of a long time, was the longer the market's held back, the harder it's going to go when it does recover. And I really think with Melbourne, that's what we'll see. Now, I'm not saying that that'll be across the board, but I think the fundamental properties, the blue chip areas, Melbourne's still recognised as one of the most livable cities in the world. Whether it's in the top three, top five, it's still a fantastic spot to be. And it is economically one of the strongest cities in this country as well. So I think fundamentally there's a lot of things that will drive it back forward. It's just going to take a little bit of time.
So let's talk of population movements there, because this is an important part of this, right? And I think what Melbourne pipped Sydney as the Australia's largest city, cracked 6 million, wasn't it, last year?
That sprawl as well.
Yeah, yeah. Is that including
Melbourne?
Including Geelong and Ballarat. But there's also been a lot of internal migration, particularly with COVID and lockdowns. We're back to that as well, where a lot of people went north, right? And so obviously that sort of, and that's one of the reasons that Brisbane is going off, because it's still got that sort of internal migration happening. What is happening with the population of Melbourne? Who is moving there? Is anyone moving in? Like, you know.
Well, I did read the other day that it's balanced out in terms of the internal migration is balanced out. That was negative for a long time, but I think my understanding is that it's neutralised now. But the majority of the population increase is certainly migration internationally coming in. So that's driving it, but that's very strong. But that probably influences more that rental market than it does the capital value market in terms of people purchasing, because most of those, or large percentage of them, are students who are looking for more rental accommodation rather than purchasing. So it hasn't really impacted on the capital value side. It's more on the rental market. But I think while that rental market continues to build, and I just don't see that there's going to be any release in that point anytime soon. So the yields continue to build, and at some point there's going to be the tipping point where that will flip the other way. Interest rates will start to come down, and then I think investors will come back into the market. Even with the land tax changes and things that we've spoken about, it'll get to a point where they can make up for that with the growth potential and with the rental return that will come back in.
I'm on a personal mission to help more people make better property decisions. And you can find out all about what I'm working on at veronicamorgan.com.au. And there you'll find resources for first home buyers, details about my buyer's agent mentoring program, access to suburb help for investors, or if you're looking to buy your dream home or an investment property in Sydney's inner west, eastern suburbs, or lower north shore, you can connect with my team at Good Deeds Property Buyers.
If you're thinking about buying your first home, upgrading to a new one, or purchasing an investment property anywhere in Australia, we would love to carefully guide you through this journey and importantly, get the finance right. Please reach out via our website, wealthful.com.au.
I can already start to see that personally. I think, Melbourne's coming up on the tables because people are looking at what they can get in Brisbane, or, you know, they're worried about going over to Perth with the run it's been on, and, you know, in Adelaide, and they go, well, actually,
Adelaide's meat price compared to Melbourne's is just, it's so close. So, and the fact that it being sustainable long term either.
So migration's been one of the strongest points for Melbourne, right? You know, it's got a lot of cultures, a lot of communities from all over the world. When people do move here to set up, Melbourne's a safe place for them, right? There are a lot of job opportunities, the unis, etc. There's also, and I imagine that's going to continue, right? Like, it's those fundamental things, they're ingrained. Rather than moving to, say, Adelaide or Perth, or, you know, even Brisbane to a lesser extent, I would say. And Sydney's got, you know, strong migration from overseas as well with the job opportunities. But what's your take on the wealth effect, right? Like, so Melbourne's just got a lot of wealth in, you know, particularly the east of the Bayside, et cetera. Are you seeing that there's this sort of, you know, a lot of pass down movement, and a lot of people are wanting to, you know, the parents are helping out the kids and the great kids. And, you know, when you're going around the traps and going to auctions and things like that, you can see that there's a lot of intergenerational money getting passed down now, like more than you've ever seen, or has it been relative to other years, or?
It grows every year, I think, especially that intergenerational transfer of wealth. Interestingly enough, I'm speaking with Mark McCrindle in a couple of weeks for Up podcast, and that's one of the things that we're going to speak about is his take on grandparents helping grandchildren as a payment, skipping a generation. And he wrote a really interesting article recently about that, so I'm looking forward to speaking to him. But I think that we're seeing more and more of that, where there is that assistance. We go to plenty of auctions and seeing parents standing next to children doing the bidding on their behalf and assisting with purchasing. And it's not just to bid for them, it's helping to finance it as well.
Yeah. What about foreign money as well? You know, Melbourne, you know, kind of what I was saying before around different communities, like, are you finding that in other parts of the market, say 2016 or something like that, when it was, you know, a big part of the Melbourne market, like, are you still seeing that, or is it to a much lesser extent?
We are, but I don't think it's as strong as what it was. It's certainly not back at those 2016 type levels.
Yeah.
And it's more than what it was during COVID, when there was a severe lack of that. But there's also a lot of second and third generation money that's coming in too. So it's not always easy to distinguish whether it's international purchases or whether or not local buyers getting into the market. And look, the eastern suburbs is very strong in the Chinese and Indian communities, and they're certainly, because the education facilities in those areas are very good, both public and private. So there's a very strong demand in those locations, and that continues, and it will continue into the future.
One of the things that I'm always interested in, I look at Melbourne and Sydney as being very similar in many, many ways. Maybe not the weather, and doesn't have a harbour, but, you know, other than that, you know, very similar in many ways. There is this disparity in terms of the value of property. You know, like a house in an inner city suburb of Sydney is going to be a lot more money than equivalent house in a city suburb of Melbourne. So I keep thinking to myself, maybe now's my turn to actually downsize to Melbourne. But a lot of commentators talk about that differential between, say, Brisbane and Sydney, and why Brisbane property prices will suddenly accelerate at different times, because that value differential sort of kicks in and people go, oh, that's it, time to, Sydney's just so expensive, I'm going off to Brisbane, then Brisbane gets a bit expensive, so it's not worth it anymore. And I've always wondered why there's that differential in between Melbourne and Sydney, because in many ways it's comparable. So it's never evened up, you know. Now, obviously, as that gap widens and you look at Adelaide median house price getting close to Melbourne, you also see Brisbane dwelling price now exceeding Melbourne, but I'll be careful, that's dwelling price and that's not individually house and apartment prices. But, you know, like, do you see people moving from Sydney to Melbourne because of that?
We have different stages. I don't think it's a strong influence on the Melbourne market, but we absolutely do see it where people look from a value proposition and feel that there is opportunities in Melbourne. I guess we can all contribute as to why we think that that gap. I mean, there's different stages where it's gotten closer, and then Sydney typically takes a step away. And I think at the moment, with what's happened through COVID, that's definitely held Melbourne back, and that's what's driven and widened that gap pretty extensively in the last 2 or 3 years. But I do think that there will be scope for that to come back in for the reasons that we've just spoken about. I think there's a lot of benefits with Melbourne. It's just that it's taking a little bit, and it will take longer to recover because of what we went through during that period.
So a lot of investors come to me, you know, for strategy sessions, and they want to know, oh, you know, I've got $1 million, where can I invest? And usually I don't even bother with Sydney because buying an A-grade asset in Sydney for $1 million is almost probably impossible. Some people may argue with me on that, but really I'd struggle to find an absolute cracker investment for $1 million. Brisbane obviously offers opportunities. Someone was to come to Melbourne and say, right, well, I decide I'm going to buy into the, you know, Melbourne be undervalued, Melbourne providing opportunities, land tax, other things notwithstanding. Can they buy a house, an A-grade house? That horse hasn't bolted, or has it come back? The horse was running off and now it's come
back. Getting close to get a good house at that sort of level, but you can. There's good spots in the inner western suburbs where you can still get a good quality house in there, which will have good streetscape, good access to public transport, good access to local villages. The primary school education facilities in the inner west are really good as well. There's Victoria universities out there. There's still opportunities in and around there to be able to get something for around $1 million.
Jared, you're finding that a lot of your past home buying clients, right? I know you guys do a lot on the investment side as well, but you know, they would love to upgrade, but they just can't make the jump. And so almost they're trapped in that house. And yeah, they are maybe thinking about renovating, but they can't really renovate to the extent they really want to. So the idea was I'd just buy a little 3-bed cottage with the idea is this will get us through till the kids are maybe 5 or 7, then we'll upgrade into a bigger house. But they just can't, whether it's borrowing capacity or the growth hasn't been there. And then the house they want to upgrade into has grown at a faster rate because the smaller ones haven't grown as fast. Like, are you finding a bit of that? The belief I bought this as a stepping stone, but I just can't step off the stone.
Yeah, there's been a bit of that, Chris, where it has been a bit harder to do that. It's probably less to do with the capacity. It's been driven probably more by their own capacity, being able to do that. The growth of the individual asset probably hasn't gone at the level that they may have expected. I don't think it's necessarily to do with gaps widening and the upper category taking off and the lower categories being stagnant or going backwards, depending upon the asset class. If they've bought an apartment in Docklands South Bank, well, that's a different story. Mm-hmm. But if they've bought something that's reasonably good, whether it be perhaps a villa unit in the eastern suburbs or a little house in Brunswick, and they're looking to upgrade to a family home in Thornbury or Coburg, somewhere like that, they'll still be able to do that. But if they purchased it within the last sort of 4 years, it'll be harder because there won't have been a huge amount of equity built, particularly if they bought it towards the end of the pandemic.
And you find it as many, confirmation bias here, right? I'm expecting Melbourne to boom. I've got a house down in Melbourne and I'm a bit disappointed with its growth, to be honest. I think it's got all the ingredients to, you know, it's a house in Brunswick and it's a good, you know, good location within the suburb, but absolutely growth's been pretty average, you know, compounding that versus other cities. Are you finding though that, you know, because of affordability, that a lot of first home buyers are trying to compete at just getting into the housing market? Like Veronica was saying there, right? Like they would love the bigger block or the more renovated place, but they just haven't got the capacity. And there's this, you know, the lower end of the market's getting a little bit more steam than the middle and upper end, just because buyers are forced to spend less than they actually want to.
Yeah, there's competition in that space, but it's not probably as strong as what perhaps it could be because interest rates are still making it a little bit harder for people to be able to take that step a bit further along. But there certainly are first home buyers around at the moment who are prepared to look at perhaps buying a 2-bedroom apartment in an older style boutique block in the inner city areas rather than perhaps they might have 3 or 4 years ago during the pandemic, gone and purchased something further out so that they could, because they didn't have to worry about commuting to work. Whereas that pool of the apartment, and we still feel as though, I mean, they haven't performed very well at all, the apartment market across the board in the past probably eight or so years. But we still feel as though they're a good stepping stone for different buyers to get into the market, because if you're taking $650,000, $700,000 to try and buy a house, you're going a fair way out in Melbourne to be able to do that.
It's interesting because the Sydney apartment market sort of ebbs and flows a little bit, right? And once again, as I mentioned earlier, when you look at apartments and you look at aggregate of it, you're looking at everything chucked into the mix. So you've got to pull it apart. In the inner city, we look at sort of, you know, at the quality buildings and the quality apartments that we would look at. We see that when prices of houses really start accelerating, first we'll see three-bedroom apartments suddenly accelerate, suddenly take off. All of a sudden, the house buyer is priced out of the two-bedroom cottage in inner areas, will then say, right, I don't want to go out. I want to stay in the inner city. Now I'm going to look at apartments and I can afford a three-bedder. So that makes sense to me. So we see those prices go. The next one to go is the larger two-bedders, the two-bedder and studies. And sort of goes down the order until, I mean, the stock standard one-bedders, they never seem to do an amazing, they never do much. But you'll see the big one-bedders with living areas the size of a two-bedder or with a study, you know, you see them take off eventually. But it comes off the back of, it's noticeable because it really comes from too much pressure in that sort of house prices. Obviously with constrained growth at the moment, I'm guessing you're not seeing that. But have you seen that in the past in Melbourne?
The interesting thing, you mentioned three-bedroom apartments. We found in the past that they've been in Melbourne a little bit anomalous in that people haven't really wanted that sort of property and there hasn't been consistent demand. And now it's become a bit of a criticism, particularly with developers, in that there's no three-bedroom apartments. Mm. So there's no opportunity for people that can't afford to buy a house to buy that slightly larger apartment that gets them into an inner-city area to give them the amount of accommodation that they're after. Mm. There's some of the older style 50s, 60s era, 70s era apartments in the older blocks where they've had a formal lounge, formal dining area, and you can convert one of those three bedroom. And there's certainly been good interest. We had a vendor advisory job for one of those properties in Elwood early this year, and that did quite well. And the agents consistently reported that a lot of the buyers were young families. They weren't first home buyers. They were upsizing from a smaller two bedroom, but they liked this because it was in a block directly opposite St Kilda Botanical Gardens. So you've got all this public open space readily available, but it gives the amount of accommodation that enables people to get into that Elwood market, because a two bedroom house in Elwood that's reasonable is going to cost you 1.2, 1.3, and a three bedroom house is going to be 1.6, 1.7. So all of a sudden, you can get in there, you've got some open space nearby, but you've got the extra accommodation that you need as well. And that was around a sort of a $900,000 type property.
Jared, every time I come to Melbourne, we come in over the Balti Bridge, isn't it? What's it? And right, you're coming down there from the airport and, you know, you see on the left side of the sky bar, so if you're driving, and you just see tower after tower getting built, right? Like, it's a bit of a game. Every time you come to Melbourne, you can just see what's the new tower coming up. What's happening on the ground now? Is there, you know, few jobs starting, you know, particularly high density, you know, approvals are obviously been dropping off for some time, but there's still a lot of cranes about. People still finishing jobs, but
I think it's more that. Yeah, I think it's more the finishing jobs, Chris, rather than new things starting. I don't think there's been as much in terms of new work and new things coming out of the ground. And for those that are, I think there's a bit more of that build to rent, which I think is probably not a bad thing to help to try and ease things, because that's probably the only way that we're going to, with the constraints that are being put on investors, that might be the easiest way to ease that rental tension, albeit some of the asking rents on some of those properties are enormous.
What about when you step away from the city, though, and you start getting into the Camberwells and the Hawthorns and Brightons and, you know, et cetera? Are you starting to find that there's a bit of a, you know, planning controls are getting a little bit more relaxed and NIMBYs haven't got as much voting power? I know Camberwell is an example of one of those spots in Melbourne. They want to increase density a lot.
Yeah.
Are you starting to see a lot of that downsize of Sky Home / 3-4 level, you know, bigger 200 square meter apartments getting built? Or is that still pretty slow because of, you know, the planning?
It's pretty slow, but there is a lot of that talk. I mean, around Box Hill and things as well. They're trying to ease planning restrictions in and around there. So it's a city of Whitehorse, and they're trying to make sure that it's easier for developers down the track and have less density restrictions in and around those areas. So there's certainly councils trying to open that up, but it hasn't necessarily flowed through as yet in terms of actual construction.
And the Mornington Peninsula area, I mean, it seems pretty dire down there, just looking at, you know, that sort of return to work challenges, the land tax targeting second homes and family homes. You know, what's your take on what's happening now?
Vacant property tax as well that's coming in. So there's all those sorts of things. Yeah, both peninsulas, Bellarine and Mornington, the markets down on both of them are certainly sliding. The supply, you only have to drive down there to see how many boards and see how much stock is available. My parents are on the Bellarine Peninsula, and Bowen Heads through the pandemic was you couldn't find a property to buy down there. It was just everything. Anytime a sign went up, pretty much went up with a sold sticker on it. Whereas now there's for sale signs all over the place down there, and prices have certainly come backwards. And Mornington's no different. Going down at Blair Gowrie and Rye and Portsea Sorrento, there's just not the depth of demand down there anymore for the reasons that we've just mentioned.
Do you think that that's actually the greatest opportunity though for them? It's you know, as return to work, you know, hybrid work starts to get more embedded. People get forced out of the Melbourne city. They start to go back to behave like they were in COVID and start actually moving down there. And
I don't think it'll go back to that where it's going to drive the market up significantly. I think it's more likely because we've probably still got a greater degree of flexibility in terms of work life and working from home balance down here, I think, because that's been the expectation because it was so much a major part of working during that time. So I don't think that it'll if anything, it's still going slowly back the other way where there's an expectation for people to start spending more time in the office. So I don't think that that's going to drive the market, improve it down there. It's probably going to get back to more of its historical performance whereby you can have extended periods of time on those peninsulas where the market does nothing. It just plateaus, and then it'll have its spike, and then it'll plateau again.
So is it plateauing at the moment or going backwards, Scott?
Going backwards. Tough down there. It's a tough market. I mean, I was down there at Easter, to be honest. Though, but it was early Easter, and it was 30. Oh, I'll say it's 30 degrees. But I'm sitting down on Mount Martha, and you know, having a swim on the beach there. I felt like I was in the Mediterranean. It's pretty beautiful when it is sunny down there, right? It's such a good spot.
It's a great spot, and when the weather's good, and it was over Easter. You're right. We did have some wind down here then. So it is really nice down there, and can be fantastic, but it's not quite coming back just yet.
Yeah. Jared, have you got a property Dumbo for us, mate?
Have I got it? I don't know if I do this week.
Oh, my God. You must have come across some things people do on property all the time.
Oh, do. I've been trying to come up with something. There's been a couple of I've had one actually recently with some clients I'm looking to help sell a property, and probably not them. It's more the tradesmen that are helping them. We're getting some work done in preparation for the sale of this property, and they couldn't get work done out on the balcony for a period of time because we're waiting on some tiles to be brought in, and then there was a big forecast. I mentioned how good the weather was in Melbourne on Easter, and then on the Monday we were out of that big forecast for a deluge, and we got it, and the tradesmen forgot to prepare for the deluge, and there's now we're mopping up afterwards and trying to get a few things fixed. So, yeah, there's your Dumbo from a tradesman's perspective. It's quite frustrating. My clients have done everything right, and then this was...
The frustrating thing is that they're preparing it for sale, did you say? So,
yep.
You know, that extra delay can really stuff around with sales campaigns, right, and try to get this thing on before sort of May, June, and the winter break.
It's pushed us back at least a week and a half. And then the difficult thing, as you both know at the moment, was that we were already managed to avoid Easter, but Anzac Day this year falls on a Thursday, so I'm mindful of that creating a long weekend too. Then you go too far the further along, and then you've got the King's birthday. So you're always looking so far in advance with auction campaigns and planning out and making sure you don't get any interruptions. And so it just creates an extra hurdle to jump.
Well, we saw that in Sydney. Correct me if I'm wrong, Veronica, you know more than this than me, but a lot of supply came on in March, right? I think it was, people were front running it, right? There's a bit of momentum in the market. It's stronger than I thought it was going to be. I'm just going to get my property on, and you know, but I think that a lot of that stuff is getting soaked up and probably has been a bit more dire in April. Is that what you're seeing down there as well? Like, it's been a lot less listings this month because of school holidays, Anzac, Easter, blah, blah, blah.
April always a write-off pretty much. I mean, Easter was late, early this year being late March, but it's really flowed on into April. And then you always have Anzac Day, and then depending upon when Labor Day for Victoria falls in that second Saturday, second weekend in March. So the first quarter is always a lot of public holidays and interruptions that you need to joggle and get around. April's very quiet, but we're starting to see a few listings build now into May.
Yep.
And when you look at the auction listings in Melbourne, there's always more properties that go to auction in Melbourne than there are in Sydney. We had a couple of Super Saturdays where we hadn't for the 12 months previously had any individual Saturday with more than 1,000 properties, so we hadn't cracked the four digits. We've done it twice so far this year, and the clearance rate held up both times in the sort of early 70s. So how is the clearance rate coping with the those Super Saturdays for you?
So the clearance rate has been reasonable is what I would say. I mean, I think February on average it was hovering around the high 60s, early 70s. And then March was probably more mid 60s. So it's come back a little bit, but that's still pretty good. I mean, that's evidence of a fairly balanced market when you're in the mid 60s. Up at 70, you could argue that it's a seller's market. So it's still been pretty good. I guess the thing to keep in mind, though, is that when the market softened and it hasn't had the depth of interest, when you get out to some of the more middle ring suburbs where whether you auction or whether you go private sale can depend upon market conditions, there'd probably be a few that are electing to go down the private sale path rather than the auction path because the depth of demand is not quite there at the moment.
Yeah, it's interesting. The clearance rate in Sydney has been very similar. Even though we've had tiny price growth. I mean, Melbourne, according to CoreLogic, zero price growth in the first quarter of this year, I think it was. Negative for the first quarter. It was zero for March. Sydney's not a lot better, really. I mean, we're not negative and we're not zero. We're sort of 0.1 or so, or 0.2, something like that. And so it feels similar. Even though Melbourne's got the bit of the gong. Anyway, on that note, we'll call me the Dumbo of the week. Thanks so much for coming along, Jared. Interesting chat. We thought it was we were well overdue for having a Melbourne chat. We've had a few Perth chats lately. We've had a couple of Brisbane chats. Time to find out what's going on in our southern capital.
Great to see you back.
Thanks, Jared.
If you have a question that you'd like us to answer in an upcoming Q&A episode, you can send us a voicemail or written question via the website, theelephantintheroom.com.au, or you can email us directly at questions@theelephantintheroom.com.au. If you like what you're hearing, please share this episode with others you feel would benefit. And while you're at it, why not leave us an iTunes review? 5 stars would be great. I know that sounds a bit cringy, but we have it on good authority that every review helps make it easier for other people to find out about us and hear what our amazing guests have to say.